Welcome to Recurring Nightmares, episode 49. I am Jeff, joined as always by Chris.
Hey.
We have a couple Frankenstein movies on this episode by my choice. We'll get into all of that and I think have a fun time with that soon. First off, apologies for the late episode. This is my fault this time. I was on vacation and it's just how it goes sometimes. And if I sound worse than usual, I'm a little under the weather. If I sound better than usual, same reason.
It's like a little bit of a deeper voice tonight.
Maybe it helps my podcasting voice. I don't know. Maybe I'll talk less. Maybe that'll help. But first up, as always, we're gonna do what we've been watching. And interestingly, like, me and Chris have pretty much total overlap this month, but I'm gonna kick it to you, Chris. What have you been watching?
Well, I'll start off with the one I don't think you watched, and that's Abigail.
Little vampire girl.
Yes. It continued my little vampire string of films. Spoiler, not going to make you guys watch a vampire movie this time out, but I did watch another vampire movie. Abigail was it, and I had a blast with this. It was a fun time. It's a dumb little movie about a gang of like criminals that kidnaps a little girl from like billionaire dad, and who's like a big crime boss type dude. But like they kidnap this girl. Unbeknownst to them, she is a vampire. And the whole thing is turns into a nightmare with them. They are locked into a house with her as she then starts to kind of off them one by one until they kind of team up to try and take her out. And then there's a twist and some fun stuff happens. And they end up having to take out somebody else. But it's a good time. Melissa Barrera, who, if you know the Scream movies, she was in, I believe, four, five, and six?
I don't know. I think four is old, isn't it?
I mean, she is, I think
she was like the new... She was like the new main, right? Or
not at first. I don't think she was the main at first, but then she kind of moved into that role. Maybe she wasn't in Scream 4. It might have been Scream 5. I could have sworn she was in there. The at least the last two.
She not anymore though. In those.
No,
right, yeah, she's out of it. Yeah,
she said something I think it was related to Palestine, actually.
Yeah.
About like, hey, maybe we shouldn't kill like kids in Palestine. And
yeah,
the producers fired her off of Scream 7. So she has just continued on, though. She picked up this movie Abigail, so she's sticking with horror. I believe she has a few more films that are coming out that are horror related as well. So she just keeps down that path. But Abigail's fun time, man. Like, I think the little girl in it, the girl who plays Abigail, Alicia Weir, she's fun. Everybody, all the like characters they have here that are part of this group that kidnap them are a good time. Melissa Barrera is Joey. Trying to think. Catherine Newton, she is familiar to me, you know, like she looks familiar, but I'm not sure what I've seen her in.
But isn't that Freaky? Vince Vaughn?
Oh, yes.
I like
her. Yes, yes. She's that one. Yes. That is where I remember her from. She's good. She plays like a goofball in this. It's like kind of dumb, but she makes it through most of the movie. Kevin Durand plays this guy Peter. You also have probably seen him in a bunch of shit. Like, it's just a bunch of people you have seen in films.
How's my boy Angus McCloud, aka Fez from Euphoria?
So he is good. He is fun. He plays like a druggie.
Surprising.
And he's the first one I think that gets offed. He gets a good death, and he's funny up until then. Like he's like always trying to hit on the two women in it, Joey and Sammy, who's played by Catherine Newton. He's trying to hit on both of them, and like they keep shooting him down.
He played a teenage drug dealer on Euphoria, and he was, I think, the most compelling part of that show.
Mm.
And he seemed authentic. You're like, is this guy like some guy that they found on the street? And I think he was, but he was also like a really great actor. And it's a shame because he's gone now. He committed suicide last year, I think last year or earlier this year.
It's probably his last. Last year, July 31st, he died. He was only 25.
Yeah, it's a real shame, and it's also part of why I think like Euphoria is in like production hell. Like they don't know what they're doing anymore because it's like he wasn't the main character, but he was at the heart of that show. What do you do now? You know what I mean?
Right.
I've heard Abigail is a blast, and not just from you. I've seen other people saying it, and so I'm looking forward to seeing it.
Yeah, it's fun. It's not like super gory, but there are like some moments of like, holy shit, like that's gross. they do like towards the end, there are buckets of blood everywhere, but it's not like, you know, there's not intestines everywhere. There's some good scenes. There's some really funny lines. I think the banter between everybody is great. It's a good time. I hope when you see it, you have a fun time with it too. Like I was like, wow, this, I'm glad I went to see this. Like
it looked fun from the trailer. Like it didn't look like anything like amazing, but it looked fun. Does the switch happen early on from it being like this, like not heist movie, but like these people are basically holding her for a ransom, right?
Yes. So the film's not very long. I think it's like a little under 2 hours, like 1:45, something like that.
Yeah.
The first third of it is like the heist and them trying to like you start meeting the characters and you know you're getting to know everybody. And then the up until like the midway point, then it's like shit starts to go weird. You don't really know what's up. Like, I mean, you do from the trailers. You know she's a vampire, but
yeah,
they haven't really revealed that part yet. And then, like, the back half is definitely they know that she's a vampire. They know that she is hunting them. They're trying to survive. And then there's another twist that you maybe don't see coming.
Okay,
that is a good time.
I was just curious because like. I've always loved From Dusk Till Dawn, how it does it. Like, it's like this good, interesting crime movie. And then all of a sudden, it's just fucking balls to the wall vampire bullshit. I've always admired that.
I would say in a lot of ways, it is similar to that, right? Like, so like that, the heist part is like actually very, I think very well done. And they play it straight up until that point. Like they're just a gang of criminals. Yeah. Like, and then weird stuff starts to happen, and then you finally do run into the fact that like she is the one that's doing this, and you get a little more of the reasoning why it's happening. But neat stuff.
Maybe a future episode idea if we run out of ideas. There you go. what else have you been watching?
So I did a double feature with Abigail. I saw Civil War. I saw Civil War first, and then saw Abigail.
Oh boy.
Alex Garland's new film, Civil War, starring Kirsten Dunst, who she's great in this movie, I think.
She's really good.
It's a movie. So it's a movie about a civil war in the United States. Does not necessarily like go, you know, these are the good guys, these are the bad guys. Although it does, like the president's a shitbag. He is basically Trump.
Yeah,
they lay that out.
He is like he is coded as Trump. Yeah. Well, I don't know if I agree with everything you just said there, but I'll let you keep going and I'll give my take.
So like that, Kirsten Dunst is a photographer. She is partnered with, I guess, a reporter. And it's a road trip movie of them moving through war torn United States. I think they're going from, are they going from New York?
Where do they start at? Is it New York?
It feels like
it's so far from, I guess.
They mentioned Philly in it, and that you can't go through Philly. Like you have to go, they have to go all the way out to Pittsburgh.
I always forget Philly is that, I like don't look at the map enough, I guess. I always forget Philly is like that far east. Like,
yeah, like where Philly is, it's 3 hours from DC and 2 hours from New York. So like we're almost in the middle.
Yeah. Your state kind of like points over that part of the US, right? Like, and then there's Philly.
Yeah. I mean, there's New Jersey is right next to us, and that's the ocean. Like,
okay. Yeah. In my head, you guys were like Ohio.
The state's very big. Like the western side of the state borders Ohio and West Virginia. Yeah. And the eastern part of the state borders New York and New Jersey and Delaware and Maryland. Like it's a big state. There's a lot of land there. So Philadelphia, east side, Pittsburgh, west side. It's always weird when people say that Pennsylvania is the Midwest because that makes no sense to me. I consider myself as East Coast. Like,
I mean, you definitely are. Yeah. It's just in my head. It was, but I think that movie helped clear that up for me. I like looked up a map or something after. I was like, what the fuck? Anyway.
Yeah. So they're on a road trip. They're going from wherever they're at, New York, Boston to DC, because the forces of Texas and Florida, I believe. I don't know. They have like a name they come up with.
I think, I forgot the something front. Western Front is Texas and California, but I think you're right that Florida is with them too, because of course Florida would be.
The Western forces are California and Texas, and then the other, I guess, the Florida Alliance. I'm looking at a map now that's on Wikipedia.
Yeah.
They have basically pushed in, and they're going to take DC from the. What is still the United States, where this dictator type president is running things. And that's all it is. It's a road trip. Like,
yeah,
they stop at different spots. You know, they're like, oh, they're, you know, there's gunfire over there. We'll go check it out in the morning. And they do. And they embed themselves with some like militia people that are shooting back and forth. They meet up with, they try to get gas somewhere. And like, they end up meeting up with,
I love that scene.
Like that are, they've hung some. I don't even know what they did. Like I don't know if they.
The guy just
expanded on that.
I just the part that sticks in my head, honestly, of the whole movie is like the guy being like, "Yeah, I'm friends with him on Facebook or whatever. Like we knew each other in high school." And I was just like, "I don't know what he's been up to. He doesn't really talk to me." That kind of like he's just like casually talking about this, like they're like torturing and killing this guy. I'm just like, and then Kirsten Dunst is just like, "Can I get a picture?" I was like, "Oh, geez."
They end up in like a small town that's like seems like they're just ignoring what's going on in the world, but not really, because like there's snipers on top of the roofs, and it's a really I think it's like a. Maybe one of the biggest, like most harrowing scenes is when their friends catch up with them, and like the little girl photographer, she jumps into the other car, they speed off, and they come across the car that's abandoned, and they've been taken by, I guess, loyalist forces, like a patrol that's burning bodies or dumping them into a body pit, and they're gonna kill them. Like,
yeah,
and Jesse Plemons,
yes,
yeah,
Kristen Dunst's husband, who gives a hell of a performance in this movie. He's there for like 5 minutes, but
brutal one.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like there's a bunch of harrowing scenes in it, in the whole film. And, you know, Kirsten Dunst, though, surprised me. Like, she did some stuff after, like, Spider-Man that just wasn't very good. And she's kind of been non-existent, really, for quite some time.
This is it's like her stepping into a new era or something for her. Like, she's like this hardened, she is the mentor, you know what I mean?
And yes.
It's just like us, we're growing up, we're getting older. So, like, we are the mentor, like, generation now. And she plays like this hardened journalist pretty damn well, I thought. Like, I found her convincing.
Yeah, I loved her, and I thought she was great. Yeah, and I mean, that's the film. Like, I liked it. I didn't love it, but yeah, I thought it was pretty decent.
I liked it a lot. I don't know if I loved it, but I liked it a lot, because it's a road trip movie, so it's very episodic, right? Like, it's like, that's how road trip movies are, right? You go to this town, and you run into these characters, something happens, you move on. But it's in this just, like, nightmare image of America that, like, if you had shown me this 10 years ago, this would have been fantastic. I don't know. Probably not, but, like, I could see it, right? Like, it's just crazier and crazier shit just keeps happening, and we just, like, accept that it happens, right?
Yeah. It's possible. Yeah. That's kind of what I took from this. Like, I hope not, but it's maybe not as big a leap as some people are trying to make it out to be.
I think it's doing well, and I think people generally like it, but there's a lot of people the people who did not like it were like, it has nothing to say. And I just think that's selling it a little short. I do think that, like, it's a little muddled in what it's trying to say, especially with, like, it's not so much trying to diagnose the problem us, like, with America, like, the division, like, it's exploiting those divisions and stuff, but it's mainly about journalism and whether, like, about how dehumanizing it is to, like, you're just, like, capturing stuff on a camera that, like, people dying, right? And whether that's worth anything. And in my opinion, like, the movie says it is not. Because all of their work has done nothing to prevent what's happening. But the director, Garland, is like, it's a love letter to journalists. So I'm like, I didn't, that's not what I took away from it. It was futile. Like, it was, it,
yeah, nothing matters. There's a line early on that Kirsten Dunst gives. It's like, I take photos. Like, I don't ask the questions. I just take the photos and show them. And I'm so other people can ask the questions. And it's like, but shouldn't somebody be asking the questions? Like, what? Like, who's asking the questions then?
The movie seems to take her stance as well, because, like, the movie does not. The movie just takes the photos for you. It's not telling you how to feel about any of it and who's right or who's wrong. I agree with you that what's his name, Nick Offerman, the president, is basically Trump, and he's like assuming a third term, and you could kind of maybe assume that's what started the war.
Sure,
they don't tell. The other problem people have with it is that it doesn't seem to have anything to say about our political divisions, or, like, in my opinion, it's not necessarily like. The president is bad in it, but I don't think it's saying that the people fighting him are good.
We don't know anything. Like, they're just as bad in a lot of cases, right? Like, they start taking
pictures of, like, if you stay in the end credits, they start taking pictures with his dead body and stuff, and it's like, it's monstrous. Like, and the journalists are kind of monstrous in it too. And I don't know. To me, to say this movie is, like, cowardly and it has nothing to say, because it's saying, like, do you really want this? Like, who's the good guy? Probably nobody. Like, you guys need to settle down. He's like, I think he's British. America being like, you guys need to fucking chill the fuck out. And maybe that's not what people want to hear out of it. I British. I don't know. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, yeah, he's British. I was just answering that. Yeah, I think that, right. You name a movie Civil War in a political climate that is what it is today. And you expect it to have some sort of statement on the politics of today. Instead, it's just like, hey, you know,
it's poking at those politics. Like, you know, Jesse Plemons pokes at those politics for sure. Like,
and like, you can identify Jesse Plemons as a bad dude. Like,
he voted for Nick Offerman, you know, but obviously he's out there killing.
And yeah, he's like, what kind of American are you? Like,
in the most casual tone to like,
while he's holding like a gun to these people's head. Yeah.
Yeah.
Insane. Like great performance by him, but like, yeah, I don't think it doesn't have anything to say. It's just, I don't know if I care for what it's saying, like, or that I want to live in like a world where like, you know, the media doesn't have, like, they're just there to show us, and then what? Because like, we need somebody to make a statement on why, because they're not gonna listen to me, right? If I go, this is bad, guys. Like,
yeah,
like nobody's listening to me.
Well, I don't know. I hear you, and I hear people's complaints on it, and I also think that, like, again, I think its message about journalism is a little like muddled. Like, he doesn't, like, it feels like he's not sure what he's trying to say, because if it was a love letter to journalists, I just didn't get that out of it. Maybe it's like the hope that, oh, them recording this for history will mean something, even if it doesn't seem like it means something now. Also, the ending, and like, not to spoil it, but the ending was like chilling, like asking for the quote. For people who've seen the movie, they'll know what I'm talking about. But at the end of the day, it's a movie that like stuck in my head for a little bit after seeing it, and it had scenes that I thought were very memorable. You know, is Absolutely. It my favorite one of his movies? I don't think it's my. I think Ex Machina is my favorite movie by him, but I liked it a lot.
I liked it. Yes. Yeah, I liked it. Did not love it. I have not seen Men, so I can't.
I have not either.
I would say Ex Machina is the one that I would be like, yeah, that's the one I really like out of his. I did not like Annihilation, but
yeah, everyone seemed to like Annihilation, but I was not a huge fan of it, and I really loved 28 Days Later, which he wrote and did not direct. I liked his TV show Devs. I'm a fan of Alex Garland, but
Same. He's coming back to write, I think it's called 28 Years Later.
He's writing that?
Yeah. And I don't know if that is in conjunction with Danny Boyle. I thought Danny Boyle was doing something with it. So I think that'll be neat. So that's Civil War. It seems to be doing pretty well in theaters, so.
Yeah, yeah, which is good, because it was A24 sticking their neck out to do something slightly bigger budget, so.
Good. It's good. Glad for that. And finally, a film that I kind of loved, actually. Late Night with the Devil.
Me too.
It hit Shudder, and I watched it today, like a couple hours ago, and I thought this was fantastic, like super fun.
I think great concept. David Desmalchian, I think his name is.
The guy who played Jack.
Yeah, the lead. The lead. Yeah. This guy has been a supporting actor for forever. And boy, he carried this thing. Like, he's really good in it.
Yeah. He's fantastic.
And, you know, I guess if people don't know what this is, it's like a late night talk show from the 70s or, yeah, right?
Yeah, 70s.
Yeah, and, you know, things are dying, he's fearing cancellation, and during Halloween of 1 year, he has, you know, as a stunt, this, you know, psychic lady and this girl who's supposedly possessed on, right?
Yeah.
I don't know, psychic, whatever the fuck.
She's some sort of, the doctor is some sort of psychologist or something. She doesn't claim to have any, she doesn't have any psychic powers, but the girl believes she is possessed by
something. And she is claiming that she is possessed too. Like the doctor believes in it, right?
Yes.
Like,
yes.
And yeah, I think the thing that you want something like this to do, like it feels like something from that time, kind of like the WNUF, you know, Halloween special or whatever it is, like something like that. And it includes things that like happened during that time in a way, like there's this guy, James Randi, that was like known as the skeptic who used to go, he would go out like on late night talk shows and this guy would be like, I could bend a spoon with my mind and even bullshit. You can, like, this is how you're doing it. Right. And they have a character like that here who is like clearly modeled after James Randi, which I really loved. Like, you have a skeptic that is like constantly telling you what you're seeing is bullshit. And I really love, like, I love it because like it like keeps things in check a little bit, but it's also like a reference to that era. That was like a thing that would happen in that era. I don't know if you got any of that out of it, but like,
yeah, I mean, it definitely feels like a late night talk show from that era, but like maybe skimming down to almost a kind of like Jerry Springer-ish type thing where it's like we have to do more and more outlandish things to keep our audience, which ends up with what happens here, right? They're delving into the occult and but it's played straight. The entire film is played straight. Like, it's not, outside of like the ending, it's not really like unbelievable that you might see this on a television.
No, this is the type of thing that would be on late night talk movies. Like, it's like so authentic to what it's like referencing, which is what I loved about it. But then I also love that like they host kind of a story. I said in my like letterbox, I'm like, this felt like a VHS like segment, but like that was like an hour and a half long on its own and earned it. And that's kind of like,
I can see that.
But like part of what makes it earn it is that like the host, like the main guy, what did you say his name was?
Jack
has a backstory. He has a wife that he's lost. They explain this, you know, in a very economical fashion at the top. And that plays into the story. Like, there's a little bit of an emotional core going on to this. And I think that really, like, made it play, especially when shit goes batshit at the end. I liked it a lot. I'll let you finish your thoughts on it.
I mean, we've talked for years between movie dudes here. Like, I love, like, religious horror and like, demonic possession and stuff like that. So, like, this plays it very straight, like, you know, Lily, the little girl who is possessed. She's not like over the top.
No.
And it's like, it's like you buy that she is possessed, but also like when Carmichael, the skeptic, starts questioning it, and it's like, yeah, I could see where he's coming from. Like, yeah, maybe it is just parlor tricks. And then he has like a cool parlor trick of his own that is really neat. That the way they play that, and then they run it back with the tape, and it's really neat. It's really cool how that plays out. I enjoy that, like, shit just starts getting more and more out of hand, and like the producer and his like assistants are like, hey, you got to stop this shit. Like, I'm trying to think of like what the guy's name is, Gus, I think, but he is, I don't know if he's like a producer or just like, you know, the guy that's on those late night talk
production,
shows.
Production assistant. Or
yeah, he's like a character, but.
Oh, yeah, like the side guy, yeah.
Yeah, he's like, they, you know, there's some banter between the two of them. But he's like, dude, you need to knock this shit off. Like, you're not a bad dude, but this is bad. I'm getting bad vibes from this man. Knock this shit off. It's like, but it's like believable. And I love how they shoot those scenes in black and white. And
yeah,
so not like it's not what's live. It's just
people had problems with that. They said things like that took them out of like the reality of like this is like a found footage. It didn't bother me at all. Like I liked seeing the behind the scenes, and I don't care if it's supposed to be a real camera watching them or we're just watching them. Like I don't. It's fine, whatever.
Well, but it's still, and I don't know how. I don't know how television production works, like today or in the 70s. But like I could see like them having a camera.
Yeah, there's a black and white
on. Yeah, that like the booth is getting, but like we're not getting. So like it's believable that like you would get these tapes from the studio. I thought the ending was great. It was actually shocking. The way it, like, I saw what was coming with, you know, and not to spoil it, because I don't want to go into exactly how it ends, but I saw, like, where they were going, where they were painting Jack as a character, and what he did to get where he ends up at.
Yeah.
But I did not see, like, that kind of final action taking place.
And I was surprised. I liked it. I was like, oh, that's cool. Like,
yeah,
it was honestly like the year is young, but there has been some good horror movies so far. It might be my favorite. Like it might be my favorite so far. Like it's just, it's fun. Like it's a fun movie. Like, and if you're into like that era at all, like I think you're gonna find it neat. And if you like found footage, I think you're gonna find it neat.
Yeah, I love the design, the set design that he has for his show, and like the sliding, like it's like the door, but it's like the, you know, it's Night Owls with Jack Del Roy or whatever the show was, but it's like just a wall that they slide back and forth for him to walk in and out between the studio and like it's just neat. Like everything looks period appropriate, and it just feels period appropriate. The audience reaction when the little girl like kind of she's in her like possessed mode and she's like, it's like, oh, like I know all about you, Jack. And you know your dead wife, and now you can fuck Dr. June to your heart's content or something like that. And it's like it's on air. Like it's like the audience is just like shocked.
Oh yeah,
you would not hear that even at midnight on late night television. So like it's like just the shock of like hearing that from the audience. Like it's great. It was fantastic. Well acted. I thought some of the special effects, especially towards the end, were neat. They were believable.
This movie, I think, also does a lot with low budget movie. Yeah.
That's why when there's a very special effects heavy scene towards the end. It's not quite at the end. It's when Carmichael he's doing his skeptic thing. He's trying to prove that like everything is a hoax here. But we're seeing it live. Like exactly how he's portraying it. And it's like neat. Like I thought like shit, like this just got gory all of a sudden.
Yeah.
Fucking head explodes. Like really cool. Had a good time with it. So it's on Shudder.
Yeah. It was in theaters shortly and it's on Shudder. I think by and large, horror fans are loving it. It did bum me out to hear like the people who didn't like it, but they are like not as we are in the majority on this one. Like people seem to really like that movie. And I think for good reason.
Good. I'm glad we're on the right side here.
So. we're gonna get into our movies for this episode, but just real quick, just want to throw out recommendation of Ripley on Netflix, which is a retelling of The Talented Mr. Ripley, but it's, you know, limited, has more space to spread out and tell its story. It's very good. Like I don't remember The Talented Mr. Ripley, but this is very good. And it's just one of those cool shows where you're watching someone try to pull something off, but they never tell you what they're trying to pull off. You have to figure it out. And it's like that increasingly through each episode, this guy getting himself into worse and worse situations. And you like are you realize like he's in trouble, he's got to do something, but it's never like explaining, like, you know, it's doing really small process stuff, like him like a fake ID or something, and it's never telling you like what he's, you just get to watch the process of that play out, and that makes it really fun. On top of the fact that like it is a beautiful looking, it is some of the best cinematography I've seen in a long time. So big recommend for Ripley on Netflix.
Okay.
Let's get into it. Let's go Frankenstein. I want a date. Let's start with Poor Things from 2023.
This is Bella. Bella, this is Mr. McCandles.
Hello, Bella.
Oh, she's an experiment.
Good evening.
Her brain and her body are not quite synchronized. But she's progressing at an accelerated pace.
Tell me, where did she come from?
I shall. For it is a happy tale.
I am Bella Baxter, and there is a world to enjoy, circumnavigate. It is the goal of all to progress, grow.
A woman plotting her course to freedom. How delightful.
It was directed by Yorgos Lanthimos, written by Tony McNamara, and based on the 1992 novel by Alasdair Gray. Came out December 8th, 2023, so Oscar season. It had a $35 million budget. It ended up doing $117 million at the box office. It had 11 Oscar nominations. It won for Best Actress for Emma Stone.
Yep.
Best Makeup and Hairstyling. Best Production Design. Best Costume Design. So I'm classing it up here on this episode with a fucking big Oscar winner.
Yeah.
Which shocks me because, I mean, I get it for, like, production design and costume, I do. But, like, the movie, to me, doesn't play as a movie that like Oscar voters would love, because it is so foul and like silly that I'm like kind of amazed that it did as well as it did at the Oscars. Chris, you have any thoughts on that before we get into it?
Yeah, it's a weird movie, man. Like, I had not seen it before the Oscars and was like, eh, I mean, I love Emma Stone, but I was like, that movie looks weird. Like, how great of a performance is she? And then, like, it was like, wow. Like, after coming out of it, I'm like, all right, yep, I agree. She is deserving of it.
Yeah, I forgot who I wanted to win over her. Probably from Killers of the Flower Moon.
Yeah, that's who I thought was going to win.
I think everyone did, cause especially since she already has her Oscar. She won for La La Land.
Yeah.
But she's fucking... anyways, this movie is... It's a Frankenstein story. It is about... Willem Dafoe is a scientist. I think his name is Godwin.
Yes.
And he has created this creation, Emma Stone. Her name is Bella. And we get to see her kind of evolve from when he creates her to the end of the movie. I'd say a very like feminist story that, you know, it has some things to say, but it's always just so fucking silly and funny, like very funny in my opinion.
Oh, hysterical. Absolutely, yeah. Hysterical.
And what it is that there was a woman who committed suicide, and that's who you get to see in like the opening scene. You see like this lady jumping off a bridge, and it is explained like 20 minutes into the movie what is going on with her. After you, there's several introductory scenes with her like acting like a toddler. But basically, what the scientist has done is he found this lady who committed suicide. The baby in her was still alive, and he was like, "Oh, perfect. I finally get to do my experiment." And he takes the baby out, puts the baby's brain in her head, and reanimates her. Which, I did not know that part going in, and I thought that was like a neat idea, like a neat twist on the Frankenstein genre. Yeah, it's like having your own fetus, like its brain being put in your head. And so she's basically like, you know, early on in this, she's like, when we first meet her, she's basically like a toddler, and she, Emma Stone is very good at acting like, I think some interesting things in like the first, I don't know, segment of this, it's all in black and white, and the score is really weird. It's like super strange sounding. I mean, the whole movie's strange in a way, but like, the score really adds to that.
It's unsettling in a way, like, and it's like weird. Like, it's exactly as you said. It's a weird score, and it's like it makes you feel weird, like, and uncomfortable because of everything that's going on. Like, it's not. This is not a comfortable film to watch, even though it is hysterically funny.
I think that like the black and white and the music too kind of reflect her evolution, because eventually we get to color, and not to jump ahead too much, but like when it jumps to color is when she's coming. I don't know if it's coming for the first time because she shoves a lot of things in herself before then, but it's when she's in, I think, Lisbon with Mark Ruffalo's character Duncan. And that's when it cuts to color, is when she's like riding him and she's about to come. The music also at that part also comes together and is actually very like, it's like transcendental. It's like beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, when it's just like, meow, meow, like I'm trying to put it stuff together. Lex G described the music as it sounds like someone's trying to tune a harp.
Sure.
And I don't think he liked it as much as me, but anyways, so, yeah, it's this journey of someone who is innocent and being, like, controlled by men, realizing herself and becoming a woman. And it does it in the most fun and fantastical way, in my opinion. We'll go through it, I guess, but there's like just funny lines I want to touch on and stuff. And if I skip over anything, Chris, that you want to touch on, obviously, stop me. And this is a hard one to discuss because like it seems so simple on the surface, but also one, it's like 2.5 hours long, and there is stuff going on in it, in my opinion. But they bring in this guy, Max McCandles. I can't remember the actor's name. It's basically a student of Willem Dafoe, who's like the mad scientist in this. And he's like supposed to watch her progress and stuff. And when he first meets her, he says, "Oh, what a very pretty retard." That's like right away. I'm like, okay, this might actually be fucking something. She keeps making progress. Another interesting thing that like happens early on that's important to the end is like you see all the other experiments like hanging around this guy's like mansion. There's like, it's like a, like these hybrids. It's like a chicken with a dog head. Right.
Yeah.
And that is, it's just laying the groundwork for where we're going at the end with the punchline here. There's also, I think the production design is incredible, man. Like, I thought for sure Barbie was going to win going into the Oscars, but then when I saw this movie, I was like, holy shit, dude. It's like these painted fucking sky backgrounds. Like, the set is just crazy looking. And this weird, like, steampunk aesthetic. Like,
It's super fantastical. And it's all, it reminds me of, like, some of it looks like a movie set. Like
it is. Yeah.
Like you're like looking at it and it's like, this doesn't look real, but also you have to realize that you're seeing life through like Bella's eyes as she's like discovering things. So it's like she's viewing things in like a very childlike manner, and like things progress. Like when she gets to Paris, like things are a little more, toned down from the fantastical. Things are still wild there, but it's not like just bridges to nowhere and stairways.
I guess that
go nowhere.
That did not occur to me. I just really enjoyed the aesthetic of the movie. I just think that like so much of it looks crazy awesome.
Yeah. Super colorful, but like muted in a way. Like,
yeah, it's really cool looking movie. But yeah, that the steampunk thing, like, there's like, you see them like riding stagecoaches. They're like powered by steam, and it has a fake horse's head just sticking off the front of it. It's really neat. But back to the plot, she discovers masturbating, and she starts doing it everywhere because, of course, she doesn't know what she's doing. She's like sitting at the kitchen table and sticks an apple at herself. And a lot of the great humor comes from things that she will say. So like a maid walks in while she's doing this. She's like fucking herself at the kitchen table. And she's like, Bella discovers happy when I want.
It is a good line.
There's a part not long after that where I get, you know, Max, the student, gets convinced by Godwin, the professor, that they should get married. Like, he sees that there's a romance going between them. So Max goes up to her and he's like, I wish to marry you, be my wife. And she says, let's touch each other's genital pieces. I don't know, you either find that funny or you don't, and I found it very funny. Like, so much of this movie is just like these people speaking like they're in an old costume drama, like this high-minded speech, but they're saying the most fucking ridiculous foul things I've ever heard. Not to jump ahead again, but like there's a part they go on a cruise ship and she goes to this, like, she just like sees this other table like looking at her. She goes and makes friends with them. It's Drod Carmichael and this older lady, and she's talking to the older lady, and he's like, you know, I don't know what she had said, but like once Duncan, Mark Ruffalo, shows up, she's like, I'd like you to meet my new friend, you know, Martha. She's not been fucked in 20 years.
Yes.
And that got like one of the biggest laughs out of me in the movie. Basically, though, Ruffalo shows up as this lawyer who is working on like the marriage contract between her and Max. You can tell right away he's like a bit of a scoundrel, but he's also like smitten with her, and he like seduces her and convinces her to like run off with him to Lisbon. I keep like jumping ahead or whatever, but like I think Mark Ruffalo is so fucking funny in this movie. Like, oh my god, dude! Like, I think Emma Stone is very funny. And I think the dialogue throughout, like anybody's dialogue is very, very funny.
The two of them together, like,
they're so fun.
Because he is, as you said, he is somebody smitten with this like very pretty retard in a way. But like the shit that he says is just so absurd as well. And he's consistently trying to manipulate her. But because she's like, she's a toddler, like
he wins.
She wins. She wins all the time.
She ruins him.
Yes, absolutely. Because she looks at things like as a child and through childlike eyes, as opposed to him, who is like, it's like, no, we need money for this. She doesn't understand the concept of money. Like, why would she?
I do love. Oh, we'll get into that. That is, like, on rewatch, my favorite part of the movie. We're gonna get into that. I fucking love that whole section. But before she runs off with him, she tells Godwin that she's going to do it. She's like, I have a secret plan to run. Like, she tells him. and she's like, he's like, no, you should not do that. You're supposed to be married. Do that after I go out and have fun. And she's like, I think she says that he will probably damage me, but it might be interesting too. But yeah, anyways, she runs off with him. They end up on this cruise ship type deal. I think this is where some of like my favorite stuff in the movie happens. Like you just mentioned. And this is also where like the movie like has things going on in it that are about things. Like they're on this cruise ship. They stop at a port and they could see like the poor people down below starving and stuff. And she's like, reacts very emotionally to this. She finds Duncan, who she's like annoyed with at this point, passed out drunk, and he's finally won in the casino all this money, and she just steals it all and goes to give it to the poor people of the island or whatever. But she doesn't even like really accomplish that because she like tries to get off the ship. They're like, we're leaving. She gives it to one of the crew members, like, make sure you get these people down to get it. They're like, oh yeah, we will. But him waking up drunk and being like,
where did my money go?
I finally won. Where the fuck is my money? It was funny the first time. It was even funnier the fucking second time. I was just like, oh my god, dude. And yeah, the cruise is where we have the scene. Like, she meets this other couple. I don't know, they're not really a couple, it's just like they're like friends on a ship. And they're kind of like pumping philosophy in her head. They're getting her to start reading. Throughout the whole movie, she's evolving. She's becoming smarter. Her language is evolving and becoming more complex. But yeah, they go to dinner at one point. I don't think it's with that couple. It's just like this random couple that they're seated with.
Oh, yeah, this is before the money thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Duncan is like, well, we're gonna do what I want to do, and we're gonna go to dinner, and you're gonna behave, you're gonna act like a normal fucking person.
Yes.
Which she can't do.
She's spitting out her food, and you know, Ruffalo corrects her. She's like, why should I keep it in my mouth if it is revolting? And the other lady sitting at the table is like, I've said the same thing before about Gerald, you know, and it's which is funny. On its own, but she just like does the quiet part out loud. Like, I'm Bella is like, oh, you mean his penis? Duncan's is salty sometimes. I'm just like, Jesus Christ. But after she does like the money stunt, they get kicked off the ship because he doesn't have the funds anymore. So, like, the next port they go to, they get kicked off, and I think it's in Paris?
Yes, Paris.
He is just like, fuck. He's just like sitting on this bench, like defeated. And she's like, oh, well, I'll figure something out. I'll go make money. And she like ends up working in a whorehouse, in a brothel, whatever. At first, it's just to get enough money for like them to get a hotel room. But like when she goes back and tells him what she's done, he's so pissed off about it that she's like, well, I think she does a calculation. I think they tell her, like, she says the calculation, which is like, I could either find another rich guy and do furious jumping with him in order to live, or I could just do. She's like, what did she say? She's like, I need food and sex. And this allows me to do that and to make money or whatever. So she just starts working at this brothel.
So I guess we should. Quantify that she calls sex furious jumping, and it's hysterical every time she says it.
Oh yeah, I forgot the first time she says it, but she's like, yeah, would you like to do furious jumping? And you like immediately go, what she's saying, it's just so, it's such a funny phrase.
So ridiculous
that my wife says it all the time now. And by the way, my wife, who is like, never gives any movies any approval, she didn't say much about this movie, but she started using that phrase, right? And when I told her that we were doing this for the podcast, like one night she's like, what are we watching? And I was like, I don't know. She's like, don't you got to watch the Poor Things for the podcast? And I was like, yeah, did you want to, like, I was going to do that like in the morning when I had my day off. You know what I mean? Not make you listen to it or watch it again. And she's like, no, that's fine. Like, and she sat there and watched the whole movie again. So like that tells me that to me is like the highest praise you can get. Yeah.
Yeah. Nice.
When she's working at the brothel, she suggests, like, they're doing the lineup where, like, this creepy looking fucking dude is gonna, like, you know,
pick one of them.
Yeah. And she tells the madam that she doesn't like the lineup system because she has to go to bed with men she finds is disgusting. She's like, she suggests that, like, maybe the women should get to choose. I thought that was a great, like, little exchange there. The madam or madame, whatever, you know, she is, like, creepy. She gets this thing where she, like, tries to bite her all the time. Like, what the fuck?
It's so fucking weird.
But she does, like, tell Bella that, like, she has to accept the way the world is. And also points out to Bella that, like, some men like that the women are revolted, which is just, like, insane. She tells her this insane thing, and then she says, like, now go fuck someone and bring me 10 francs. They show her fucking, like, all sorts of freaks, including, like, a father who brings his sons in.
Fucking creepiest, like, one.
It's like when this movie, like, anytime you think this movie can't top when it's, like, already done, like, this is an Oscar movie, and they have a father bringing his sons in to watch him have sex with a prostitute
while he has them take notes.
Yeah, like, he's teaching them about the birds and the bees. I think even Emma Stone says it at one point, like, you know, you could do some choking or a finger up the ass to move it along, and then it makes them come. See, you're like laughing because it's just so fucking insane, dude. Anyways, she eventually ends up going back home to.
She's been writing letters to Godwin all this time, so like he kind of knows where she is, and I guess they finally do track her down because he's sick.
Yeah. And she's going back home, and she's going to marry Max. Now, before I move on with, like, the rest, and, you know, there's not much left, but, like, there's a funny joke, like, running joke through the movie about Godwin, which I somehow, like, I have no idea how I did not catch the first time. But Godwin looks like this guy who is, like, experimenting on himself a lot. He's got scars all over his face. He hooks him up to this machine so he can release gas, and he, like, releases bubbles out of his mouth and stuff. But it's not him that did it. It's his dad. He keeps mentioning how his dad did all these, like, experiments on him, and he was such a great dad. And I don't know how I did not catch this joke the first time, but basically, like, he had a very abusive dad who made him the way he is, like, you know, figuratively and literally, like, he, like, deformed his son. And I don't know. I thought. You know, there's something going on there too that I thought was, like, interesting and funny. At one point, I think Mark Ruffalo was like, "Dude, what is that thing you're hooked up to?" Like, and they're sitting at the table, and he's like releasing the bubbles. He's like, "Yeah, my dad took out part of my gastro, whatever." He's like, "Turns out that you need those things." Anyways, he gets almost, like, all over. Like, she goes back to Max. And she actually tells him about how she was a prostitute for a while, and she's asked if that's okay. And he says, you know, it's your body to give freely. And she says, I usually charge 30 francs. And he says, that seems low. It's just, I don't know, man. It's always funny, even when it's being sweet, it's funny. And you think it's almost over. Like, all right, this is wrapping up now. But there's, like, one more thing left to tie up that, like, maybe you didn't expect it to tie up. It just feels like the movie's almost over. And then all of a sudden, like, the guy from her past life shows up from before
the original woman's life.
Yeah, before the original woman committed suicide. It's this rich asshole named General Alfie. And he like reclaims her. She like goes back with him to see the life that she should have had. And I do love when they pull up to his fucking mansion. He pulls out a gun as they roll up to the place. He's like, "My servants and I have not been getting along. I fear an uprising." It's so fucking funny, dude. It does not go well with Alfie. He plans to like mutilate her genitals, like cut off her clitoris at the very least. I think, you know, completely mutilate her. He threatens her at gunpoint to drink a sedative so that they could do the operation. She pours the sedative in his face. He accidentally shoots himself in the foot. And so she takes him back to Godwin's place to improve him. And at the end, Godwin dies. She and Max, they now own the mansion and all the experiments. And she kind of assumes the role of Godwin, where she's not fully evolved and she's as smart as the guys.
Yeah, she says before, I think, that she ends up with going with Alfie, her ex-husband from her past life. Godwin kind of asks, like, what does she want to do with her life? And she says she wants to be a doctor. So she kind of lays out that she wants to follow in who she views as her father, Godwin, in his footsteps. It's just neat because you mentioned that like Godwin's dad like performed all these horrible experiments on him to cause him to be the way he is, and then he did that to what becomes, you know, his two daughters, because we don't really mention Felicity.
Margaret Qualley, who is like my new, like, I love her so much. She's his new experiment.
Yeah, but these are like his daughters now, and but she, like, you know, Bella has decided she wants to go and become a doctor like him. But you see the empathy that Godwin had, being, you know, is now gone kind of into Bella. Like they're not the nastiness that his dad was. Like, they're still fucked up, but like they've evolved and they're more emotional and empathetic.
And she puts Alfie, she puts a goat brain in Alfie's head. And the very end of the movie is like, they're sitting in the garden and Alfie is like crawling around with the goat brain, like sounding like a goat. And the final shot is just her reading a book. Like, everything is perfect. And then the music comes together again. Finally, it's very beautiful, like closing, you know, ending credits music. And actually like really nice end credits. Like, they look cool. That's Poor Things. It sounds like you enjoyed it, Chris.
Yeah.
What did you think?
So that opening, you know, it's like maybe 20, 25 minutes in black and white. It's fucking weird. Like, we kind of talked about it. The music's like,
it's all weird. I mean, the whole
word in and right. But it doesn't really like, I'm not sure what the fuck I'm watching. Like, at that point. And, but once she kind of goes on her journey of self-discovery, it started to click then. And I was like, yeah, this is fun. Like, and then just more and more, like, the dialogue is just so ridiculous. And Emma Stone and Mark Ruffalo are absolutely absurd, where everybody else around them is, I wouldn't say they're playing it straight, but they are not nearly at the absurd level that those two are. So like, there's this weird fantasy land going on with these two, and that they're a blast to watch. And so yeah, I ended up really, really liking it towards like, I mean, maybe about 20, 25 minutes in, it clicked with me and I was like,
yeah,
I was on board for the rest of the way.
Same. I have never liked anything Yorgos Lanthimos has done. I haven't seen everything he's done, but I've seen at least two of his other movies. Didn't like him. Kind of wrote him off, and so like was not looking forward to this, did not see this before I did my top 10 list, and was kind of like really surprised by this. It's just fun. It's a fun movie. What's your rating, Chris?
I'm gonna go 8 of 10 here.
For me, yeah, I can't even say everything I have to say. I'm gonna go 9 out of 10. I really, really love Poor Things. Like, I just think it's so fucking funny. Horror elements, I guess. I mean, it's a Frankenstein story. There's a little bit of gross stuff, but
a little bit.
I mean, it fits. I think these two fit as a very fun double feature, and the other movie is not super horror heavy either. But boy, I think these two are a fun double feature, and I recommend them before we even get into Frankenhooker. But yeah, Poor Things is like a 9 out of 10 for me. I just absolutely love it.
Ton of fun.
So our second movie is Frankenhooker.
The makers of Basket Case and Brain Damage bring you...
Want a date?
Frankenhooker. Jeffrey Franken has a plan.
I just want to bring him back.
He has the ingenuity.
We need female body parts.
He has everything he needs, except the raw materials.
Just hold still. Excellent. Oh my God. Bunyan!
Jeffrey's creation is alive.
Looking for some action?
Oh, yeah.
She's sexy.
On a date? You going out?
I'm on my way home, but thanks anyway.
And she's sutured to please.
Listen, I'm looking for a very tall, attractive woman. She's purple. She's got fresh bars on her.
She's in the bar.
Now a motion picture like no other. A tender story of love and romance.
On a date?
A gripping tale of lust and revenge.
Incredible.
Some assembly may be required.
This was written by Bob Martin and Frank Henenlotter, directed by Frank Henenlotter, who gave us the Basket Case series. He also directed another movie we reviewed called Brain Damage, which was like the guy with basically like a drug metaphor. This, I don't think got a proper theatrical release. It came out, you know, it says on Wikipedia, June 1st, 1990. As far as I could tell, it maybe played like a day or two, like a weekend at like, you know, probably New York and LA or whatever.
It made some money at the box.
Yeah, I mean, like, it says 205,000 box office, but it's honestly probably only for a day or two. It did not even play in Times Square where part of it was shot. It was, Wikipedia says $2.5 million budget, but from Frank Henenlotter himself, he said it was $3 million budget, but that was to do two movies. It was to do Frankenhooker and I think Basket Case 2 or 3, I forgot which one. But he basically shot them back to back. Like it was basically one production. Like they did this and they did Basket Case at the same time for $3 million. Obviously you can't do much at the box office when it's a straight to video movie, but the movie has lived on as a cult classic, like a lot of Frank Henenlotter stuff. And this movie, I don't know, like I want your opinion. Do you think that like does this work as a double feature with Poor Things? And do you see like the parallels that I'm seeing with it? Because like I think it's like it's almost like it like this was ripped off to do Poor Things.
I mean, I don't know, not sure about that, but I do see the you know the similarities here, and I think it does work as a double feature. It is a movie that features a bunch of hookers, and you know it is a Frankenstein movie, similar to you know it's maybe like Poor Things is a Frankenstein movie using like the metaphor of bringing people back to life, and that like this is more like I mean the movie's even called Frankenhooker, but it is not hiding its Frankenstein drawback. In fact, I think like the Frankenhooker, like her last name is Shelley, which is you know
he's Shelley,
Mary Shelley that wrote the original novel, and yeah, so I see why you would choose this as a double feature. I think it works. Yeah.
Oh yeah, I don't really take credit for it because other people noticed it before me. Maybe even like people are like, yeah, this is just like Poor Things is just like a, you know, high budget fucking Franken hooker. Also, Jeff Franken is the boyfriend's name, the main character.
Yes, it is.
But I do think that, like, Emma Stone looked at the performance here from Patty Mullen. I do think, like, there's things that they both do. It almost feels like a wink to what Patty Mullen did in this. And on top of that, the ending of this, I feel like, is very similar to the ending of Poor Things. Like, I actually forgot that part. I was like, I forgot what happened at the ending of Frankenhooker. And when I got there, I was like, oh, yeah. Poor Things basically not ripped this off, but it's very, very fucking close. Anyways, this was a Troma release, but I don't think Troma really had any part in it. It wasn't, you know, most of Troma stuff is directed by, I think, like Lloyd Kaufman. I mean, they have other directors too, but they also just released some shit. And I think this is that case here. Like, because the funding that Frank Henlotter got wasn't even from Troma. I think just Troma just helped with the distribution.
Yeah. So when I turned this movie on,
I know you said that, and I was like, was it? I was like, what is he talking about, Frankenhooker? I had no idea. You like posted about it. I was like,
yeah. I was like, oh no. Oh, like, I bought. They're not all bad, but like they are of a low quality. This is not a Troma film. Based on the, like, the title card or whatever says that they help produce it or distribute it or whatever, but it does not feel like a Troma film.
It's like, it is, I think it feels like it kind of does, but it's
in a way, I guess.
Frank Henlotter is like a much more accomplished filmmaker than a lot of the stuff that like Kaufman puts out.
That's more what I mean. Like it is a movie that like is shot like a movie. Like a lot of Troma stuff is just so bad.
Yeah, they have like some of the same sensibilities. Like it's low budget. We're gonna figure it out somehow, right? Like we're gonna do this. It's completely independent. But Henlotter, like, he has a certain magic to the stuff he does. I really like enjoy this and Brain Damage. I actually have never watched the Basket Case series. Yes,
I'm not seeing them either.
It starts off with like this kid. He's like, he works for the electric company, Jeffrey Franken, who's played by James Lorenz. But he like has a side hobby where he thinks he's like a scientist or something. He's got a brain in a fucking thing of purple juice, and the brain has like an eye. Don't understand what the fuck that is. Where did he get a brain with an eye, or how does that work? But his girlfriend is Elizabeth Shelley, like you said, played by Patty Mullen. They're having like this party. I think it's like a birthday party for his dad, right?
Somebody's dad. Yeah, I'm not sure if it was.
I think it's his dad because she buys him a lawnmower. It's like she's trying to impress his dad or something. Like she buys him a lawnmower. And a lawnmower looks like a fucking snowblower, but like evil. Like I've never seen a fucking lawnmower look like this in my life. Like, what the fuck is this? And she's like, it's remote controlled. You just gotta press the button, and it fucking runs her over, and she gets killed. I think at this point, go ahead.
Well, Jeffrey is like, don't stand in front of it. He mentions it like multiple times. Like she doesn't move, and then she starts it up. Bad shit ensues.
I think in this opening scene kind of establishes like, all right, this is what it is. Like, you're either gonna have fun with it or not. I think like, yeah, I do think like if you like hate the opening, you're like, this is terrible. I don't know if you're gonna like come around on it. I don't know. Like to me, I was just like, that's great. This girl got run over by a lawnmower in the first 5 minutes. This is gonna be fun. Have a long extended opening credit sequence with him drawing up plans to revive her. He's like, and this becomes like, it's very subtle, but it's like a running theme. And I don't know if it's subtle, if you consider it subtle or not. But like, he's saying ways he'll improve her as he's like drawing up how to revive her. He's like, oh, get rid of that chicken neck, get rid of that mole or whatever. He's like, I'm going to make, basically, he's going to like turn his girlfriend into the perfect woman.
Yes.
Which I think plays very well into the punchline ending of this, which I do think is similar to Poor Things. I do think it's kind of slow after her death for a while. Like, it's like a lot of Jeff's like watching the news and he's talking with his mom and he's moping around. He has a romantic dinner with her severed head.
Fuck it. Yeah, like that. That's a thing. If they like, oh, the head was missing. We never found the head. Like,
yeah, he's got her head, and the head just looks like a doll's head. It looks so fucking fake. And he's like pouring wine into her head. And it's like dripping all over the table. Again, it's like this is low budget. It's goofy as fuck. But like, you either like get the humor or you don't. I think. Like, I don't know. I do think that some of the stuff early on is a little slow. And some of it, like, is, like, he does this thing where he, like, he has to drill his own head to help him think.
Very weird.
I don't get it. And it was one of those things that, because they played this on Joe Bob, and Joe Bob asked him about it, and he's like, yeah, that was something I got notes on to take out of the movie. And he's like, but I just like it. And, but that's the kind of guy he is. He's like, I don't care if it doesn't work. Or it seems too silly or whatever. He's like, I want to put it in because I like it. So that's the thing that he does. He like drills his own head and it, like, helps him think.
And like he has like a map of like the brain that's like with quadrants. And he's like, if I do this one, if I drill in this spot, it'll give me the answer. All right. It's very weird. But okay.
But his scheme is not just to like bring his girlfriend back to life, but to make her the perfect woman. And in order to do so, he comes up with this like, he's gonna go to Times Square for hookers and kill them and take their parts. I mean, that's it, right? That's his plan, right?
Well, so he's gonna go get one, it seemed.
Was like it gonna be one? I thought he's gonna take the best from the best of all of them.
His plan was to just get one, make her pass out, and then bring her back and do the surgery on her. Shit goes bad, though, and he gets all of them in the most ridiculous way possible.
Yeah, and he like sets up a party with a bunch of them. He goes and meets their pimp, who's just a super muscle-bound dude in a fucking nightmare bathroom in New York.
Fucking named Zorro.
That's right. He buys crack off of him, like a shitload of crack, but then he goes home and he like turns it into super crack, which is like so he intends to like kill them with the super crack. Or I guess like you said, just one of them, but it ends up being a whole bunch.
Yeah, because like he goes through this whole thing, like if I use just enough of it, like they won't feel anything. It'll be like a painless passing, and then I'll be able to bring back Elizabeth.
Which I think this movie has like a hurdle that it's trying to go over, which is to make him still like likable despite what he's doing, even though I think the movie comes down against him at the end.
Oh yes, like, but I think his performance though is like goofy enough that you're like, yeah, I'm kind of all bored with him.
Yeah, he's just kind of like a dumbass, like. So when he gets to like this hotel room with these hookers, I think this is when the movie really comes alive. Like, I was kind of bored rewatching it until then. But the scene with the hookers in the hotel room is just like pure 80s. I mean, it came out in 1990, but it's pure 80s fucking ridiculousness where they're all having fun. They're partying and he's like examining their body parts. Like he looks under like a magnifying glass at this girl's nipples, and he's like, awesome. Utterly awesome. And they're just like all having a fucking ball. He's playing a doctor, you know, examining them. They finally find like the super crack in his doctor bag, and they start partying, and it's a very fun scene. And a lot of totally gratuitous, like, fucking tits and ass. Like, this movie is a movie that knows what it is and just goes for it. And then it gets. I mean,
if you're going to make a movie called Frankenhooker, like your poster is like a terrifying tale of sluts and bolts. Like you best provide the nudity. Like we need to see the boobs and the ass here. And like you got to give that.
There's a ton, and especially a scene, like, you get more than your fill just in this one scene. But that's, then the movie, like, wins me over completely once they start doing the super crack, because it blows them up. And it's just so funny, and the effect is funny looking, like, because it's so obviously fake looking. They'll cut from, like, a human to, like, just a fucking mannequin standing there that blows up.
Yes.
And I think I remember messaging you. You were like, I'm fucking dying, dude. I don't know how I forgot, because it's my favorite thing in the whole movie, is this whole sequence in the fucking hotel room where they're all blowing up. The fucking pimp walks in at one point, like, what the fuck is going on? And the fucking one girl blows up, and her fucking, like, leg goes flying, or something, or her leg or her head goes flying at the pimp. So he's got all his body parts. He goes back home, and he's got time. He knows there's a storm coming. He's got to really start doing classic Frankenstein shit. He puts her together, and he raises her up to get hit by the lightning. Now, I do think that this scene with him putting her together goes on forever. Like, it's
too long. It's a little too long, and it's pretty fucking stupid. Like, he's in a suburban house in New Jersey. Yeah, it's like, I got the perfect leg. And he, like, stitches her all together, and then they, like, do the wide shot out of, like, and you see the... He has, like, a sunroof that, like, elevates this bed up into the sky so it could be electrocuted. It's very dumb.
It's just, like, it could have been, like, a 30-second scene. You know what I mean? It goes on for, like, 5 minutes. And you're like, okay. He's, like, digging through, like, his body parts that he has. And you're like... I think part of it is stretching it to make it a full-length movie, because this movie is only, like, 85 minutes long as it is, right? So... but once she comes to life, I think Patty Mullen is very fun as Elizabeth.
Yeah.
And I think that, in my opinion, Emma Stone kind of took notes from her a little bit. She goes up running around, like, New York, just bought a date, going out. And it's like, it's a kind of the famous thing of this movie is her running around, New York saying these stupid catchphrases.
She's saying what the hooker said.
Yeah, she's
like, it's like the last things that they said. Yeah,
because it's like, it's
her brain. That's what
it's so her weird brain. About it. It's like, have you ever seen a movie called Body Parts? It's from like 1992, I think. Also,
I believe so.
It's like this guy, he loses his arm and he gets an arm transplant. I want to say. Which is also like, what the fuck? But it was from a serial killer. And since because it was from a serial killer, yes. Like, yeah. Like, I think it's Jeff Fahey.
Yes. I've seen that. Yes.
It's kind of like that, where it's like, because she has their body parts, somehow that, like, affects her brain. It's weird. Some funny shit in the back half. She has sex with this like short, fat, bald man, and he blows up from her electricity. And his severed head after he blows up is like, oh, that was wonderful. Jeffrey goes down looking for her. He goes down to Times Square. He's like, I think he's in his doctor's outfit and stuff still. Some guy starts trying to talk to him in Swedish. He's like, what are you, some kind of Swede? You're talking Swedish to me in Times Square. Like, it's just, I don't know. It's just like ridiculous fucking dialogue. Some other guy tries to, like, kiss her, and you get this hilarious shot of a dummy head flying out of a window because his head blew off. I think the final confrontation goes back to his place, if I remember correctly. Yeah.
They end up back at the bar where Zorro's at, but yeah, then they do end up back at his he Jeffrey comes in, gets Elizabeth from the bar, and Zorro follows the two of them back to his house.
Yeah. Oh yeah, okay. I think in the bar is where Zorro punches her head off, like, very unceremoniously. Yeah. It's like the main character just fucking punches her head off. But yeah, he takes her home to repair. Her personality comes back. She remembers the party and the lawnmower. He explains everything that's happened. And yeah, Zora... Oh, no, he gets... Then Jeffrey gets very unceremoniously killed because Zora walks in and fucking chops his head off. Just like, seriously, just like... Pfft. You know, like, what the fuck? But because it's setting us up for like this punchline ending. The cooler... He has a cooler full of other reanimated body parts and...
Well, because like his basement or wherever he did the experiment is not like set up very well. So like the electricity from when he brought Elizabeth back flew into
into the
cooler.
Then you show the reanimates
all that. Yeah. So it's like this grotesque like blob of like arms and legs and
heads. They look like have you ever seen the movie Society?
Yeah.
They look like that. Like they're like these weird fused body parts that come out. And it's kind of impressive because like Society had a bigger budget than this. The parts drag the pimp into the cooler and they give him some crack, I think. Like whatever. He's gone. And then Elizabeth decides to revive Jeffrey, but punchline ending, she's using body parts from the hookers. So he wakes up.
Yeah, because that's another thing, right? Is like Jeffrey says, he can only his estrogen based serum only works on women, so he can only bring back women. That's right.
Yeah.
He comes back as a woman.
He wakes up. He's got tits. He's got vagina. All that. And he's like, and that's the ending. I think personally, I think that's like a great like punchline ending. Like, it takes a movie like this that's just like super low budget garbage and gives it like just a little bit something to say about it. Like, you know what I mean? Like there's kind of like, there's this whole thing going through about how he's going to perfect her. Then she perfects him and he doesn't like it so much.
Yeah. Also he's not very good at perfecting. Stitches.
He's not good at anything.
Her nipples are purple. Like, he's not great.
I would go out with Frankenhooker.
All right.
Anyways, that's Frankenhooker. It's a fun, breezy 84 minutes. I mean, I think there's parts that are boring. Chris, what do you think of Frankenhooker?
Yeah, same. I think like there's some lulls in it, but like when it's hitting, especially like the in the hotel room.
Oh my god!
Or having a party like that is just a blast of a time. Patty Mullen walking the streets, like, as because you know she's going back to where her hooker parts think she should go, so she's going back to the bar. But like that whole adventure of her like walking, you know, taking the subway, walking the streets, picking up a John, it's a good time. It does seem. The 84 minutes, but sometimes it does seem a little too long because like
there's just not a lot there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's a good time. I had fun with it.
Yeah. So rating?
I'm gonna go 6 out of 10 here.
All right. I'm gonna go 7. I just find this to be fun. Like it's nothing great. But I think it is good enough and memorable enough that it stuck with us all these years later. I mean, this came out in 1990. People still really like this. I think there's a reason.
Yeah.
But I just don't like it. It's hard to stack up against something like Poor Things, in my opinion. I think that's the winner tonight.
Yeah. I mean, Poor Things is just
higher pedigree.
Higher pedigree, better acting, just like a. More fantastical, like it just looks phenomenal.
Yeah, it you know, I think it holds up against it. I think again, I think they're both fun to watch together. But it's an uphill climb. It does not win against Poor Things. I did a poll, also Poor Things won.
Not surprising,
but I like Frankenhooker quite a bit. I like both these movies. I had a fun time doing this.
It is. It is a. They were good fun. I could see why why one would pair them together. Like, yeah, they're both, in many cases, Frankenstein movies.
Chris, what are you pairing together for our June episode?
All right. So I said that I would spare you the vampires for coming up June. So I was looking around, and I came across one in my Shudder watch list that I had kind of saved. And I started looking into it, and we are going to do The Toolbox Murders.
Okay.
From 1978, directed by Dennis Donnelly. And we're going to do Tobe Hooper's remake, his 2004 Toolbox Murders.
All right. I did not, when you said Toolbox Murders, I was going to say the Tobe Hooper movie because I had no idea it was a remake.
Yeah. So it's the 1978. And that one is on Shudder. That's called The Toolbox Murders. And then Tobe Hooper in 2004 did a remake of it, which changes a lot of it as well, I believe. And that is just called Toolbox Murders.
And have you seen these movies before? I've
not seen either one. Okay. The Toolbox Murders was like, it came up on like a list of like classic slashers, like early proto slashers.
The original. Yeah.
Yeah. And
I'd only heard of the Tobe Hooper one. I had no idea it was a remake. So this is, it's all new to me. I've not seen that either. So
yeah, I've seen neither. I was fascinated that one, we watched Tobe Hooper movies here before. Are great. So like, I was like, oh, he like remade this. This works perfectly.
Exactly.
Double feature coming in on it. So.
All right, Toolbox Murders next time.
Yep.
Come back.